Hi, I'm Jared Sebesta, host of Repurposed. Thank you so much for downloading this podcast.
If you actually believe there is a creator, though, that would mean that the creator may have a plan for the creation. And if we're part of it and he's actively and lovingly interested in us, then the great journey would be to fulfill the creator's loving and majestic plan.
Hey everybody, and welcome to Repurposed, a show dedicated to inspire you to live a life of purpose, intentionality, meaning, and of impact. I'm your host, Jared Sebesta of Taegis Financial Group, a retirement planning firm based in West Central Minnesota, where we teach and inspire what we call true wealth. If you want more information on our firm, just go to our website, taegisfinancial.com. By the way, there's a free gift for you just for listening here today. Well, on this episode of Repurposed, I'm bringing you part two of my conversation with Dr. Charles Jackson. Dr. Jackson is a creation scientist. I was first introduced to him when my wife and I watched the film Genesis: Paradise Lost. And in this film, several scientists were interviewed, all contending that we can find the origins of our planet, of our universe, of ourselves, of our purpose in the book of Genesis. And if you haven't listened to part one yet, I encourage you to check it out. We talk about a whole host of topics, all of which I find fascinating, how, you know, faith and science can coexist. We talk about the age of the universe and of the earth. Again, I find this very interesting. I have a scientific background, so just on a personal level, I find this stuff just fascinating. You can find last week's episode by going to myfaithradio.com. Well, in this show, we talk about, again, another topic of mine that I find fascinating, the dinosaurs. Where did they come from? Where did they go? Did man and dinosaur exist together? And we talk about the original supercontinent, Pangaea, which we all learned about in grade school, and Dr. Jackson's stance on how the continents are arranged on the globe today. And at the end of the show, we discuss how this all ties together with creation and our own purpose. Here's part two with Dr. Charles Jackson. As far as trying to figure out how old things are in our world, I remember when I was a kid growing up and in science class, my textbook said the farther down you dig, you see older. It's just the deeper you go, the older the animals. Is that true? And the fossils that we find deeper into the ground, what do you say to that?
Well, the law of superposition in geology says that the deeper layers are older. Now, that makes sense. I mean, if you're making a parfait, the bottom layer is the layer you put on there first. Or if a whole bunch of snow settles down and you have five snowstorms, obviously the bottom fifth layer is the first snowstorm. The law of superposition is true, but it doesn't tell you how old each layer is. It just tells you the bottom one is the oldest. So you have to assume a lot of things to say, oh, well, we go deeper and deeper, and so this is millions of years each layer. If Noah's flood really washed across the face of the globe, it would have sloshed back and forth and left many different layers as the ebb and flow and the tidal forces and the depositional environment changed. You'd have had lots of layers, just like we see, of all kinds of sedimentary rock. And this would not, these might be 20 minutes apart or days apart in their age, not hundreds of millions of years. There are many, many problems I see logically with what we see in the fossils and what they say these layers are like and how they form.
So what you're saying is that the flood basically just more or less proves the idea or the theory of a global flood. And on top of that, you're finding marine fossils on top of mountains all across the world, which would also prove Noah's flood in Genesis.
Well, uplift could bring ocean bottom fossils up to the top of mountains because the crust buckled and, right, and cracked and bent. So I don't think that Mount Everest, which has seashells at the top, was covered by the flood, because Mount Everest probably wasn't there at the time of the flood. Mm-hmm. The mountain building events probably happened in the last stages or after, you know, right after or right at the end of the flood. But we do see a progression of fossils. We do see creatures that lived under the muds of the oceans, the same creatures that live under the muds of the oceans now, are in the bottom layers. The creatures that skitter around at the bottom of the ocean, right above the mud, you know, things like clams and crabs and trilobites, which are extinct now, they're in the next layer, and the next layer up has the littoral zone creatures, the free-swimming fish. The next layer has the amphibians, and this is the order in which they would be overtaken by the sediments and buried in Noah's flood. It's also the order of an imaginary evolutionary sequence, and after the amphibians would come the upland mobile creatures, the reptiles, and then the mammals and birds, which are more mobile and able to escape the flood waters for longer. Plus, mammal and bird bodies float when they drown, like in Noah's flood, which would also explain why they're all near the top, not because they're recent arrivals to the community of living things on our planet.
Oh, interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Talk about Pangaea, okay? It's pretty obvious when you look at the globe, the continents kind of look like pieces of the puzzle. And when I first became a Christian and it was like, yeah, you know, Christians say that the Earth is only 6,000 years old. And I'm like, yeah, but the continents move like inches per year. And the Pacific Ocean is thousands of miles wide. I mean, science would tell you that it's taken millions of gajillions of years for the continents to slide that far. It's no doubt that there was like one supercontinent. And then an evolutionist would say is that those continents broke apart and rapidly moved during the flood, correct? How would that happen?
Well, yeah, creation scientists would say the continents did break apart and rapidly moved during the flood. Right now, the continents, most of them are moving only about the rate that your fingernails would grow. We don't deny the jigsaw puzzle fit of the continents. Creationists and evolutionists both believe that there was the supercontinent of Pangaea, and before that, the supercontinent of Rodinia, which would have been the first continental mass in the history of the world. We just believe that they came apart and came back together and did all the mountain building. We creationists believe that happened faster in a matter of months by what's called runaway subduction theory, which is the geologic model of Dr. John Baumgartner, who is a research scientist retired from Los Alamos National Laboratories in New Mexico, who also created the world's finest computer simulation of continental drift, the Terra program. It's an article in Newsweek magazine back in the 90s all about Dr. Baumgartner called The Geophysics of God, talking about the consternation of the world's geologists that although Dr. Baumgartner had the most accurate and a wonderfully hailed program on a Cray supercomputer simulating continental drift, that he was a 6,000-year young Earth creationist at the same time, which really upset a lot of people in the secular community.
What would cause that for the continents to go that fast? Is it because all, you know, there was so much water underneath the Earth's surface, and once that came about, that there was more fluid? Or what's kind of the quick answer as to how that would happen?
There is another competing theory to Baumgartner's theory that it was fluid, the hydroplate theory. That's Walt Brown's theory. He's a creation scientist also. Dr. Baumgartner believes that it's really continents floating on molten magma that's under the continental plates in the upper mantle. And there are many mechanisms that he describes in detail, but that basically once the process of continental drift began, his principle of runaway subduction would take over, where the heavier, cold, leading edges of continents that were taking a dive down the subduction zones would actually speed up, kind of like if you had a chain, a big heavy chain on a table, and you yanked one end of that chain and it started coming off the table and spiraling down onto the floor, just the weight of the chain would drag the rest of it with it, and that the continents did something similar, which caused, until they locked up, eventually continents would have run into each other because they were riding on really subducting ocean plates. Continental plates don't go under into the mantle. It's the ocean plates, the oceanic plates that do that. And eventually continents would have run into each other and locked up into the positions that we see now because the ocean plates would have locked up.
That is so interesting. I can't wait to ask you about this next piece of the puzzle, if you want to call it that. I have said to my wife, seriously, in the last 6 months, because I'm reading books about dinosaurs with my children, I said, when I get to heaven someday, the first thing I'm asking God is, what is up with the dinosaurs? Were they real? Did they really exist this long time ago? What was the point? You go against, obviously, the secular viewpoint that they existed long before man was ever around, but you believe that dinosaurs and man existed together. Talk about that.
The first glaring evidence of that is that every major ancient culture in the world, like they have stories of a giant global flood, they have stories of giant reptiles, oversized reptiles that swam in the ocean like mosasaurs, that flew in the air like the pterosaurs, and that walked on the land like Order Dinosauria. All the dragon legends are really pretty accurate descriptions, except that they're a combination of these, of the land-walking dinosaurs, the water-swimming, and the air-flying reptiles from the dinosaur age. Only the land-walking ones have the dinosaurian leg joints, which classify them as Order Dinosauria. The other ones aren't technically dinosaurs, but they're giant extinct reptiles. And these are all described in the Bible and in legends from all major ancient cultures in the world, that people did once see giant reptiles that were like this. And the only descriptions you can give really fit the dinosaur descriptions. When Marco Polo explored China from Europe, he found out that they had the exact same stories about dragons that the British did, that the European dragon stories were, and they were strikingly similar. There must have been some sort of a historical root in that, but there are scientific and biblical other reasons also.
Is it true that the word dinosaurs didn't even come around till like the 1840s? Like before that term didn't even exist. Is that true?
Yeah, Sir Richard Owen coined the term dinosaur in 1841. He was the first curator of the Royal Museum in London and was a Bible-believing Christian. And he actually was against Darwin's theory for his entire career. He invented the word dinosaur or terrible lizard, and he didn't think that they were things that didn't live at the same time as people. He's the one that found the fossil that they always use in the horse evolution story, and he named it the Hyracotherium, after the rock hyraxes mentioned in the Bible, because they were about that size, like rabbits and conies. And the evolutionists later changed the name of his fossil to Eohippus, which means dawn horse. So, the word dinosaur didn't even exist until 1841. Before that, if a T-Rex had gone running through the streets of London in the 1600s, people would have said, behold yon dragon. They would have just called it a dragon.
Mm. So even before the mid, seems like 1800s, if you were to ask somebody how old is the Earth, would it have been fairly consensus that it's this young, more 6,000-year-old Earth rather than the millions of years? Is that kind of what the pieces of the puzzle I'm putting together?
Yeah, the Jewish calendar and the biblical time frame was pretty much assumed by most scientists up until Lyell's time in the early 1800s. So people did assume that. Now, of course, as time went on, they realized their theory, what with the fossils and the way they believed about them and the living creatures and what they believed about how slow evolution would have to go, they jacked it up from millions and millions of years to billions and billions of years, and it still hasn't been enough. That led to Haldane's dilemma, which said that there really, even in evolution stories, there's not enough time for monkeys to have enough successful mutations to mutate into human beings. That's J.S. Haldane's dilemma.
Regarding dinosaurs, this is just a question I have, just a personal question. Did dinosaurs, in your opinion, make it through the flood? And were they on Noah's Ark? And if so, why did they die after the flood?
Well, the general consensus among creationists is yes. Noah was told by God that he was going to bring two of everything that had the breath of life in its nostrils, and we can tell from the fossils dinosaurs had nostrils. Of course, the swimming ones would have been okay, but like the birds, the flying dinosaurs would have had to have been on the ark, and the land dinosaurs would have had to have been on the ark. So we believe they were there. People say, well, there wouldn't have been enough room. But don't forget, baby dinosaurs hatch out of little teeny-weeny eggs. Even the 140-foot dinosaurs hatched out of an egg the size of a football. And that was the biggest egg we've ever found. Most of them were, you know, about the size of three golf balls lined up together. I'm talking about T-Rex eggs there. And so even the giant dinosaurs, their babies, hatched out no bigger than the size of a poodle. Yeah. And dinosaurs didn't get to growth spurt till they were 5 years old, and they were only on the ark for 1 year.
Hmm. So how come there's no giant dragons walking around today?
This is actually a mystery not only to the creationists but to the evolutionists too. Larger body sizes are actually metabolically more stable. And when you look at the reconstructions and the drawings and paintings of what these dinosaurs must have looked like, they were very good predators. They were very good at filling the niches in which they lived as organisms on our planet. Maybe a comet, maybe the climate change, maybe there was something genetic about the dinosaurs that made them more susceptible to the long-term buildup of mutations, and they just had it. Or the new climate of the Earth after the flood might have been too much for them. Still, we do think that many of the forms survived into as late as the Middle Ages. The Bible does talk about the wilderness as being a place of the hissing of dragons. And the legends, even up into the Middle Ages, of dragons existing. Probably they were very rare, and there were only a few species left, and they finally did go extinct. Just like we almost extincted the grizzly bear in this country, because, I mean, they were eating our sheep and killing our kids. People might have been afraid of dinosaurs, like St. George and the Dragon, the story about him, and the dragon legends, knights were always slaying dragons, and I don't know, maybe they tasted good too. Maybe they went extinct because they made good barbecue. There are a lot of reasons, there are many dozens of reasons that evolutionists have given why the dinosaurs went extinct, and they got together after Luis and Walter Alvarez brought forth the asteroid impact theory in 1981, and many years later, scientists got together and voted that it was an asteroid and that's it. Hmm. But, you know, voting isn't really a good way of determining the truth, and the jury is really still out on why the dinosaurs are extinct. We do know they are, though.
Sure. That is really interesting. We got about 6 minutes left. I want to ask you one more question about evolution. Then I want to talk about, like, purpose and what the Bible and even Genesis has to say about why we're even here on Earth here today. But let's talk about biogenesis and the Big Bang Theory. I'm familiar with the first and second laws of thermodynamics in my weather school. Why don't you talk about what those two are and how the Big Bang Theory just doesn't add up to those laws?
Well, the first law of thermodynamics says matter and energy can't be created or destroyed, but the Big Bang Theory starts out from the first steps with all the matter and energy in the universe suddenly appearing out of nowhere all by itself. So we're starting off bad. And then an explosion somehow creates an ordered universe with star systems and galaxies and galaxy clusters and superclusters and super string clusters. And many astronomers, as you've pointed out, are deists because the universe is so incredibly well organized. The idea that a random explosion could have placed so many things in such an order is absurd. Now, I'm not saying they're all Bible believers, but most of them believe the universe is just too orderly. There's got to be a God, somebody organized it all. And so the second law of thermodynamics is the one that says that everything's going to disorder, not in the direction of order. And for an explosion to create order is unheard of and is unscientific.
When you bring up these types of points to an evolutionist, What do they say when you say, well, at the beginning of the Big Bang, you're already breaking the first law of thermodynamics of science, which is you've created something out of nothing. I'm sure you've had the debates in open forums. What's the response? What do they say?
Well, they dive into a flurry of mathematically derived theoretical statements, and it's the argument from authorities, well, everybody knows this. Why don't you believe it? that it's possible to get all the matter in the universe with that. First, they used to say that the laws of the universe didn't exist yet, so they weren't really breaking the laws of the universe. And then they started saying, well, there are ways that the first law can be broken. Well, then it's really not a law. Basically, it's wishful thinking. Sometimes I can get them to admit that they actually believe in miracles just like I do, that the breaking of a law, a proven law of science, is a miracle. They just believe it can happen all by itself. I believe it takes a deity to break a law of nature.
So they'll probably say, why, you know, if you believe in creation, then you believe in God. If he created all this mass at the beginning, then who created God? What do you say to that?
Well, of course, there's an easy answer to that. They say, who created God? I'll say, who created the Big Bang? Both God and the Big Bang are what we call an uncaused first cause. And so they've got the exact same problem, just on a different level. Who made the Big Bang? If the Big Bang made everything, then what made the Big Bang? We're completely on an even level playing field when it comes to that question.
Interesting. We got about 2 minutes left. Let's talk about the consequences of evolution. How does this play into our faith? And even more so, the point of this podcast is about purpose and deriving purpose and living with purpose. Talk about the two different viewpoints and where purposes derive from.
Well, I once heard, I was present when Dr. Richard Dawkins was talking, and the title of his talk was The Purpose of Purpose. And he spoke for a long time, gave a lot of examples, and concluded that there is no purpose, only subversion of nature's purposes. And really, it's an illusion to think that anything really has a purpose. And if you are really an honest atheist, that would really have to be your position, that there is no purpose to anything. We're a random fluke of the universe, and we're going to be gone again soon anyway, so just don't stress or belabor the fact. Enjoy whatever you think you're enjoying, even though you may or may not really exist, and you're certainly not conscious, because there's no such thing as a soul or a mind, just chemicals inside a lump of matter inside your skull that's called your brain. It's a lot different of worldview. If you actually believe there is a creator, though, that would mean that the creator may have a plan for the creation, and if we're part of it and he's actively and lovingly interested in us, then the great journey would be to fulfill the creator's loving and majestic plan. But of course, there's no plan. The absurdity of existence and life, and maybe even the fact that it's all an illusion, would be a pretty nasty part of a worldview that says there's no such thing as love or morality at all.
Can you find a connection between purpose, love, morality, and a non-creation worldview? Is it possible to connect the dots?
Well, most non-theist people will just say, well, they'll start to say there's some sort of spirit to the universe and get into pantheism, saying that the universe is God and we are all a part of it and God is me and God is the tree I'm standing next to. And they'll start to get very, very metaphysical and actually very religious sounding for people who say they don't believe in God. Or they'll just say the material universe is all that exists and there isn't really any purpose. But there are many people who don't believe in God that say, oh, yeah, my life has a purpose. But, of course, as humans who are capable of thought, whether we're conscious or not, we decide what the purposes are, which basically Jared says, we're God and not somebody else.
Yeah. This is just fascinating. I wish we had more time. Where can people find more about you?
I'm on Facebook under the profile, the professional page, Points of Origins. Now, both of those are plural. You don't want to end up in an acupuncturist or a travel agency. Points of Origins. And then I've got, you can just be in connection with me there. And I often have little short video blogs on current events in science and how they impact the creation evolution controversy.
I have to ask, what do you think? Did you agree with everything he said, and did it challenge your belief system even as a Christian? You know, whether you agree with every single detail and stance that Dr. Jackson has here, I think it's important that we seek truth. But here's the thing. If you are a true born-again Christian, you have the Holy Spirit inside of you. And he is the great counselor and revealer of truth if we seek him and truth with our whole heart. One thing is for sure, though. Without God and creation, there is no purpose for this life. Well, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Repurpose. Just a reminder, this show is based on a book by Ben Tejas called Repurpose, The Untold Story of Retirement in America. If you want the first two chapters of that book totally free, just go to our website, tejasfinancial.com, and click on Heard Us on the Radio. Also, a big thanks to Faith Radio for helping us sponsor this program. If you missed any or all of this episode, visit myfaithradio.com to hear or download the podcast there. I'm Jared Sebesta. We'll see you next time on Repurposed. Hey, thanks for listening to the podcast of Repurposed. This media is only available because of listener support just like you. If you want to make a gift right now, you can go to the website, myfaithradio.com. And if you do that, we would appreciate that so much. Also, thanks in advance for sharing these podcasts with your friends online. It's an easy way to help spread the impact of Repurpose. And just one more thing, subscribe. You can find Repurpose on iTunes or your favorite podcast player.